I don't know if we're going to look at the whole bill or whether you just want to.
There's not actually that much that is changing. Or whether you just want to hear from the ANC input on the jurisdiction question. All right, Chair, the issue was the question of the Constitutional Court jurisdiction, Clause 167.2. We didn't have a position before, but we had, as ANC, different views. One was particularly from myself around, was it necessary to amend 167.3? What was sort of broken? The Constitutional Court effectively could decide almost anything of a constitutional or related matter. We've both discussed it, thought more about it, discussed it as a study group, and the view of the ANC is that the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court should be extended. However, the issue of the wording would be something that we would need to look at. So the wording in 167A2, which is incredibly wide. Any other matter, if the Constitutional Court grants leave to appeal the matter on the grounds that the interest of justice require that the matter be decided by the Constitutional Court. So we don't have a position on that yet. I mean, so what I'm saying is our movement is to say, yes, we agree the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court should be extended from what it is currently to constitutional or related. However, that wording may be too wide. We did note that the SCA judges were proposing the wording a point of law of general public importance. That was the wording that they had submitted in a memo somewhere along the line. There may be other wordings. The idea was basically that it needs to be, you know, we don't want a situation where the Constitutional Court gets overburdened by giving too many appeals. Interest of justice, well, I'm a single litigant and I lost my case and I'm now appealing to the Constitutional Court on a non-constitutional issue. It's in the interest of my justice that the Constitutional Court hears the matter. You know, so that's the difficulty. It may be too wide, whereas the SCA one of a point of law of general public importance is narrower, more definable. The reason that we've come to this view was a view that I mean was also linked to the issue of the SCA and the powers of the SCA. And the other sort of more contentious issue in the before the committee around whether the existing introduced provision that the SCA may decide appeals on any matter arising from the High Court or any other court except where an Act of Parliament provides otherwise. And this specifically relates to the Labour Appeal Court and the Competition Appeal Court, which their legislation, LRA, the Competition Act, specifically precludes appeal to the SCA in certain cases, not all cases. And our view was, look, if you do have, obviously the more layers of appeal, probably the better decision that you would get end up with. But on these matters of both competition and employment, you can't spend forever. You can't have too many. You can't keep appealing and appealing. So we felt that it was important that this provision as it stands in the bill remain, and in other words, that where the LRA or the Competition Act precludes include appeals to the SCA, the Competition Court, Appeal Court, and the Labour Appeal Court. Matters do not go to the SCA. However, as a check, if it's a more fundamental issue, that then the Constitutional Court could hear it, and that is one of the main reasons we've then agreed on. I mean, in fact, the Constitutional Court currently could almost hear anything by saying it's a constitutionally related matter related to the right to strike or whatever. But we thought it would be better to actually spell it out that it's not just limited to trying to find to fit in the issue of constitutionality. So basically, it's highlighting two points that we're very keen on the amendment to 168.3, which precludes the appeals to the SCA for certain competition appeal matters and I think labour appeal matters, and then to widen the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court, but to look at more options with the wording of that. So you don't have a situation of the Constitutional Court takes on or is required to take on too much, but it's a narrower test than is in the introduced bill. And that you know, Mrs. Langer, I mean, we have discussed this issue before. I think we'd always veered away from it because we tried to steer the committee away from it because we thought, well, we may in fact not be amending that section, but now we're making it clear that we are. I think there could be more than discussion around the wording of that text, either in the committee or Mr. De Lange could come up with proposals.
Thank you, Chair. I'm pleased that the ANC has reached this conclusion. The difficulty with the present jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court, as well as that proposed in the bill, is that they are in fact both too wide. The present provision of hearing only constitutional matters is too wide simply because there is no clear dividing line between constitutional and other law, and therefore we end up with a situation where the Constitutional Court can and does take almost anything. The proposed amendment that they could take any other matter in the interest of justice, although that is the line of thinking that has been developed over these many years by former chief justices, most eminent constitutional court judges, and this was their thinking. That too ends up giving us a jurisdiction for the Concord which is very wide, and one worries about everybody chancing their luck by going on a further appeal to the Constitutional Court. My thinking on this was first influenced by Supreme Court of Appeal Judge Carol Lewis, and I have earlier on in this process proposed that the section should read the Constitutional Court is the highest court of the Republic and may decide points of law of significant public importance on appeal in the interest of justice, you could add if you like. We have all long been thinking about this, and it was only when we visited the Constitutional Court that remarks by one of the judges there alerted us to the fact that the Supreme Court of Appeal had in fact addressed this issue in a memorandum to us, which we never saw, by the way. At the memorandum dated 2009, we then asked our research expert to go find this document for us, and I have found it very useful. What they propose is a point of law of general public importance, whereas the one I had proposed was significant public importance. They make the point that this will also mean that all issues relevant to the decision of a case that contains a point of law of general public importance and evidence that might be relevant to those issues should be ventilated in the lower courts. So it therefore becomes a very effective filter. We're dealing only with points of law, only with general public importance, and it therefore should constitute a real filter. They themselves say that these appeals should not necessarily be filtered through the SCA. in a matter of general public importance, the ethics court should be able to grant leave to appeal directly to it under suitable circumstances. And which addresses the concerns that I had previously shared with you about subsection 6 and the right to approach directly the constitutional court on constitutional matters. That, of course, was modeled on the German constitutional court, which upon our visit to Karlsruhe, we discovered deals in 96% of everything they take and have over the life of that court are these direct constitutional complaints, which J.B. Skorsana compared, I think most solicitously, to the work of the Human Rights Commission in South Africa or the Public Protector. 96% of what the German court takes is that kind of complaint or case. And it was just yet another illustration to me or to us that modeling our constitutional court on the German or any other civil law country is just, at the end of the day, doesn't work. Now, I had therefore thought that we should delete subsection 6, but the constitution, the SCA judges say, and I think this is persuasive, that in a matter of general public importance, the apex court should be able to grant leave to appeal directly to it under suitable circumstances. And I think that this is good because the one concern that one has had is that cases of individual injustice might not have been able to reach the court. If this filter is applied, the points of law of general public importance. But if we retain then, on the argument of the SCA, we retain sub 6 as it stands, then it makes it possible for a case of individual injustice, which might have general implications, a general public importance dimension, still to go there. So I find that persuasive also. It seems to me that this is the way we should go. I'm pleased the ANC thinks so. And as to actual wording, it's the United Kingdom and its new Supreme Court of Appeal that gives jurisdiction on points of law of general public importance. So that is perhaps the model that we may wish to look at. On the other matter, 168.3. Now, I remain reluctant to amend the Constitution just in order to render an act of Parliament constitutional, that's the Competition Act. But I'm sorry to answer that position, but I think I heard the Honourable Jeffrey leave some possibilities open for grounds upon which more layers of appeal might still be able to be used. And I would just, I don't know if anybody else has had a chance to read David Lewis's book, Enforcing the Competition Act. Judge Dennis Davis recommended it to us. He makes it quite clear in a chapter on the CAC that what they wanted when they drafted the law, all of them, was a court that would be both expert and final. They didn't get final because in the ANZAC case, which is very interesting, you really must read this chapter. The ANZAC lawyers were specifically playing with for 10 years they strung this thing out in the courts, and at the end of it, they conceded what had been charged. They'd been charged with some of the beginning of cartel behavior. But they were cheerfully using the courts to spin the thing out. But what I find interesting is, in the end, they got a court that's neither expert nor final because the JSC declined to appoint economists to sit on the CAC. Quite rightly, I think they insisted on appointing judges proper. So in David Lewis's view, they are not in fact experts. And I was reading the end of the chapter last night, and in fact, he says that a specialist court develops special interests, and that an optimum solution would be then, in fact, it's only one of the things he says, so I don't want to mislead you. But the optimal solution would be one that allowed direct appeal from the tribunal to the Supreme Court of Appeal. In other words, you then discontinue the Competition Appeal Court. This is not an angle that I knew existed, but there you are. So let's see if we can find grounds upon which ANC would still be willing to look at multi-appeal layers. If the competition appeal court doesn't appear to have turned out to be just what its progenitors were thinking of in the first place.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm broadly in agreement with what Honourable Smuts has said. Welcome the ANC's position that they're not going to go along with the bill as introduced, that has been too wide, and that one can look at what the FCA has suggested, which will in effect broaden the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court, but not as broad as the bill that is introduced. So we'll look at that with interest, and we welcome that. Then as far as the, and again, I held the position that if it's not broke, why fix it? So I think, you know, we need to be open-minded and reconsider our position. But the sticking point will be the SCA issue, and I'm really trying to be as open-minded as possible, understanding what the judge, Dennis Davis, argued and the need to deal with cartel behavior expeditiously and quickly. I would still like to hear from the SCA judges, and I don't know whether I was going through my documents. I don't think we've heard from them. I can't remember at all on this issue. And obviously it strikes to the heart of their jurisdiction. We'll be taking away from their jurisdiction and adding national legislation into the Constitution, which is a great concern to me. I like what Honourable Smuts has suggested as a possible excluding the CAT and going straight to the SCA. If it's an issue of time, one can make up a case for an expeditious appeal in the SCA, as was done in the Prince judgment. But that's something I haven't thought through it yet. There might be other complications with that. The problem with the CAT at the moment, you've got the tribunal that is economist. They are the court of appeal, and it's the first judges that are then hearing the matter. So it's three judges on appeal. The tribunal has got no judges. And I think it's like the full bench here hearing a matter from the beginning as the first instance. And I've got a bit of a concern about that. But at the same time, I fully appreciate the concerns about time. So we need to look carefully at this. It's a very complicated and difficult issue. And can one just lump the two together and say the Competition Appeal Court and the Labour Court are the same? I seem to recall even the Constitutional Court expressing concerns about the Competition Appeal Court and their knowledge of competition law and them being required to deal as the final court with that, and having concerns from their side about the exclusion of the SCA in competition matters. I speak under correction, but I seem to recall that being a view somewhere that was held by the Constitutional Court. So I think we've got a lot to think about. I appreciate the Honourable Jeffrey wants to finalise this, but they are weighty issues. They have massive implications, and we need to deliberate. And I would, it would be great if we could have a debate between Judge Davis and the SCA judge or something. But I would like somehow to hear their views, even if it's in writing, on the possible exclusion. And then if it's the way to go, one's got to look whether the insertion of national legislation is the required way to go. And does that not open? How does one close the opportunity of the finance minister saying, well, the Income Tax Act must also, I mean, income tax, we're under deficit, we can't go via the SCA, it's huge economic implications. Therefore, we also want to exclude the SCA. Now, even if it must go via the Minister of Justice to reach that conclusion, what is to prevent a Minister of Finance making a compelling argument to the Minister of Justice that court must also be excluded from the SCA on grounds of finance, on grounds of national economics, and that is my concern, that at the end of the day, the SCA's jurisdiction is left to nothing. So let's be very careful as we consider these issues. Thank you, Chairperson.
Of course, we have heard Judge Dennis. So yeah, I rather like the idea of hearing this, however we do that. But it's just my suggestion. Oh, sorry. Yes, JB, my apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. Briefly, I would just like to make an input insofar as the competition appeal court and the labor appeal court, and to say maybe another consideration that the person has to look at is that the avoiding the many layers is also a contribution to access to justice, because litigants who are there, some of them, you must remember that it has to deal with employees and the like. Now they are contesting with maybe big business, and then big business can deliberate and take them through the SCA and thereafter towards the constitutional court. Now, if maybe what we are doing goes towards limiting the several layers, I think that would be better insofar as access to justice is concerned. Disappointed by the response from Ms. Smuts and Mr. Swart, because I mean, some of the points were covered. I mean, the issue of why you have the CAC was an issue that was canvassed directly with Judge Davis that wasn't contradicted, and that was precisely that the SCA would not be able to hear matters urgently. The Prince appeal was very much an exception because it hung on a single point and could therefore be dealt with expeditiously. But what we are effectively doing in terms of the proposal is not to make the to make quite clearly that the CAC and the LAC are not the final decision makers. But there is then provision for if something is wrong in limited circumstances, for an appeal to the Constitutional Court. So you don't have to twist around trying to look for a constitutionally related matter to take it there, but you'd argue for something else. And there does seem to be general common ground on a point of law of general public importance. So in other words, the CAC or the LAC made a mistake about the law, and it is sufficiently important because this is going to be a matter that will continue to, or that will set precedence, that it goes to the CAC. So it's clearly not the CAC and the LAC become the courts of final decision-making. It is then easier to appeal to the Constitutional Court. Why then have this other chairing party, the SCA? That is the problem, and it will increase the cost. It will increase the time on issues that are subject to time constraints. So I'm a bit surprised that issues, as Mr. Sibagnoli says, of access to justice, it's also the cost of doing business. I'm a bit surprised from the DA. I mean, I understood that the DA wanted business to be able to move faster, decisions to be taken faster. And then anyway, the record of the SCA, I mean, in I can't remember the cases, and I speak under correction, but I think in two relatively recent cases, the Constitutional Court overturned SCA decisions that in turn overturned an LAC decision and a CAC decision, and went back to the decision that the Labour Appeal Court and the Competition Appeal Court had made. So it's just, it would be nice if we've got lots of time and lots of money and we weren't competing with, we didn't have a problem if people are unemployed, if they need to get another job. We weren't competing with other investors from other parts of the world. And then we could have the FDA. We could maybe have another one if we could afford it. But we don't. And I think what other, I mean, generally it's two layers of appeal. In this case, we're actually providing three. The Honourable Smuts and Swart, Honourable Swart wants four. So even in the case of, and then going back to the fact that the Competition Appeal Court Tribunal, Competition Appeal Tribunal is not a court. Well, as Ms. Mustard pointed out, the proposal originally was a sort of really expert court of economists. But in any event, you still have, even if you don't regard the tribunal as a court, you still have two layers of appeal. And I think across the world, you generally don't get more than two layers of appeal, maybe sometimes three, but definitely not four. And four is what they seem to be arguing for.
Just as I recognize this, maybe Mr. Smuts and Mr. Denial may have a question. Can I do? I certainly do. I should have asked you this earlier. As I understand it, then what you're saying is you're going to the CAC or the LAC, not satisfied with their judgment, then appeal to the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court will consider your application for appeal. If it turns you down, that's it. As long as you understand that, okay? So you don't have now say, okay, Home Court has turned me down, I'm jumping and going to the ACA. So that's it. Because that's essentially what Dennis Davis, Judge Dennis Davis, was requesting. Right.
No, I wasn't, as the Honourable Jeffrey himself articulated the first point I was going to raise, which is that the tribunal is not a court. And let's not forget that Chief Justice Mogoeng himself made this point to us, so it is relevant in considering the competition authorities. The same does not apply for the Labour Court. I was going to say that. Now, thank you, Chair. You have articulated one of the problems here. Of course, what if they turn you down, that's it. And though I suppose Judge Dennis Davis would argue that would then be simply comparable to the competition regime or the employment regime in other countries where you have one or two layers of it. Let me just say that I want to go and think some more about this and also need to take some caucus, DA caucus funding. May I repeat what I said when Judge Davis was here? I am really sympathetic to the need for expedition in competition matters. I saw the dominant incumbent in telecoms, if not strangled at birth, then still off in infancy, many little telecom startup companies. It's a terrible thing, because once you've killed them off, they were the little internet startups. Once you've killed them off, they're dead. And that is counter to what we all want for this country. So I am actually really sympathetic, and the ANZAC case only reinforces that. I mean, it's ludicrous, the American Natural Soda Ash. It's ludicrous that they were able to spin out for a decade and then concede cheerfully at the end if they had in fact been guilty of that behavior, anti-competitive behavior. Leave us to think about it some more, but to me the crucial thing will be the door that you left open, or the avenue that on the new definition of the jurisdiction of the front court, that would be a natural avenue also for a view on competition matters. That's what I want to think of. Thank you.
Well, at the moment, you have to apply to the SCA, and they could turn you down. And you apply to the Common Court, and they then turn you down again. It doesn't make much difference. And obviously, the fact that what we are providing for is an ability to approach the Constitutional Court. The they must consider, does it fit in whatever the definition is that we are wanting to put to the text. And presumably, if there's merit, they would consider it if there was going to be injustice done. I mean, I'm operating also on the basis that we're all human. No court is perfect, not even the Constitutional Court.
Sure.
So you can always have a wrong decision, a bad decision. It's just how many can you afford from a time and a cost point of view of litigation.
this was an important aspect of our discussion on this matter. Well, I don't know how much is left. There's a few more issues in your document, Mr. Dinari.
But this is sort of, those were the main two on the constitutional amendment. What I would suggest is that as far as the 167 amendment, that Mr. DeLange has heard the debate, heard the issues. There's one in clear proposal of point of law of general public importance, which I think could go as an option.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Mr. DeLange could look at other options and discuss. Then as far as the other thing, I don't think it's a wording thing. I think it's parties to have further consideration on the matter. I would suggest from a time that we maybe go for written. I mean, because this was in the introduced bill, so it's not a new point to come up with. Obviously, they are going to argue that they do not want to lose the jurisdiction. But let's give them the opportunity, even though they didn't take it before, to hear it, and then let parties consider.
Is that okay, Mr. Swart?
Right.
But they've still, Mr. Jeffrey, without moving away from this bill, they've still requested an opportunity on the criminal procedure. All right.
I think this is the Constitution 17th Amendment Bill of Bill 6 of 2011. And I know from the judiciary side that there's sort of repeated inquiries into when we are going to be finishing this. But even if we don't finish the Superior Courts but finish the Constitution Amendment, let's aim for that.
Yes. Now the crucial clause, the ones that are not under contestation between us, the Chief Justice just make ahead of the judiciary and we start setting up the separate branch.
I think we do also need to look, because in a sense, I think it was Mr. Swart brought it up, that, and it, I know I've raised it with him before and it doesn't seem to sort of take the bait, but, the Minister of Justice being the only person who can introduce bills dealing with the caucus. And now I don't think we can put that into the 17th Amendment because it's a new issue and we would need to be advertised. But I think we should pursue that as far as looking at the committee amendments. That would obviously have to be next year. The two can't go together. But there's an undertaking from the ANC to put forward that, to pilot that. I hope that would have an impact as well.
As a committee?
Mr. Anderson. Mr. Chairman, ask the Honourable Jeffrey, why would you want only the Minister of Justice to introduce legislation on the courts? The same could apply to each and every department. Only the Minister of Home Affairs to introduce legislation on immigration, and so on and so forth. What is so special about the Minister of Justice and the court, which should prevent the rest of the members of Parliament to deal with the matter? And how is that different from any other department?
Basically, if you're worried about committee bills and private members' bills, it's not trying to impact on those. The issue is that at the moment, the Labour Court and the Labour Appeal Court are dealt with in the Labour Relations Act, which is a bill from the Minister of Labour. The Competition Appeal Court is in the Competition Act, which is the Minister of Economic Development. So the idea would be, because we are setting up the Chief Justice as head of the judiciary and eventually an agency or whatever running the courts, that they should all be interlinked. But you can't then have a situation that amendments come to the labor court about what the labor judges should be doing, which then fall outside, didn't have the specific blessing, the active participation of the Minister of Justice. But the intention is not to restrict. So it's something a bit like Minister of Finance and the Money Bill. The intention, though, is not to restrict private members' bills or committee bills, but to stop other members of the executive introducing bills that affect the courts.
And in addition to Mr. Jeffrey's explanation, there was a real concern expressed within the committee about the plethora of courts springing up all over the place, water courts, tax courts, and so on, which pretty soon get out of control, and the resources for those courts come from the Department of the Ministry of Justice.
I have sympathy for the argument, but two considerations, Mr. Chairman. First one, if that is the concern, one would guess that the best way of addressing it is through a cabinet circular. The President tells ministers that all bills establishing courts need to be brought to cabinet by the Minister of Justice, and one doesn't need to amend the Constitution if there is any modicum of cabinet discipline. The second issue, whereas one has sympathy on the notion of not proliferating courts, see, when it comes to courts, it's like hospital beds. You wouldn't have a problem with proliferating hospitals because the number of hospital beds determine the function of the hospital. You cannot multiply hospital beds, patients, and cases by multiplying hospitals. By the same token, the multiplication of courts does not multiply cases, number of judges, hours required, number of files. And one seems that if we multiply courts, we are multiplying the function of the judiciary, but it's identical. The number of cases is identical because if that case is not brought in the water court, it's going to be brought in the high court or the magistrate court. So there is an argument to be made for the efficiency of the multiplication of courts. In fact, they are specialized, they are faster, and the same cases would be dealt otherwise elsewhere, with the lesser degree of specialization and speed. So before venturing in that constitutional amendment or a discussion about it, I think we should have an analytic discussion of whether it's the type of concern you raised are indeed valid in point of administration of justice.
Except this time, you see, I think that debate has taken place in this committee. And regrettably, you weren't present. I'm not blaming you for that. But if the committee feels that they want to have another bite at that particular debate, then it's entirely up to you. Okay. All right. So we've left Mr. Bilanga and Mr. Smuts with some instructions. Do we leave it there and okay, and go back?
Chair, we will revert to you quite soon, probably by the end of this next one.
Okay, fantastic. All right, then we'll go back to the Superior Court's vote.
Thank you, Chair. If I can continue, we were close to 12. On page 10 of that document. As I said earlier in the meeting, 12.1b and new B being added, that is the one that's been raised with the Chief Justice and is probably now the subject of some discussion amongst the judges. Let me just go through it very quickly, Chair. The idea of this proposal is to to regulate the quorum of the Constitutional Court a little bit more. It says that any decision, as contemplated in 157.5 of the Constitution by the Constitutional Court, first, that an act of Parliament, provincial act or conduct of the President is unconstitutional, or second, confirming any order of invalidity made by any other superior court, must be supported by a majority of at least two judges of that court. And there's a fairly lengthy footnote that I've inserted there, Chair. I'm not going to go through that now. But this is the first time that the committee has actually seen something concrete in front of it. I know that this has been this raised informally before, but the committee would probably like to make a few remarks on this, or otherwise just simply vote on it, Chair.
More remarks. I mean, last time we spoke, Chair,
yes.
Mr. De Lange and others, I forget, maybe J.B. We're thinking through a strategy before approaching the judges on our behalf to raise the question of the eight-member bench. And is this the fruit of
The strategy was, in fact, to come up with something concrete and to play.
This
will be working informally. We made it very clear. Not a proposal emanating from the committee. We closed it in that there's been discussion. What would they think if something like that is being considered? Just obviously, it is not a proposal by the committee. At this stage, it's just something that's been raised for some consultation and consideration.
On it last time, it's good sort of seeing something sort of down on paper, but effectively the impact would be it would abolish acts of Parliament. I mean, linked to the separation of powers, that you can't just have one swinging judge. There needs to be at least two. It's moving closer to, I think, the German model, which I think is in fact three, a margin of three. Yeah, I think they're quite. That's one of the things that they mentioned in their constitutional court. So that where the judiciary, the constitutional court, is going to find things that the legislature and executive have done as unconstitutional, it can't just be one judge who's dithering and who then sort of slightly opts for that one. It needs to be two judges. So 4-5 splits are then out. 4-5 how high do we get? 6-5
Okay, so I know, and I'm so tasty. You see, a judge decides on a point of law. There are two parties before a judge, and the judge decides who is right and who is wrong. In the case of a collegial judge, that needs to be done by a number of judges. You cannot have, from a logical point of view, from a formal legal point of view, a different decision-making requirement if you decide on the one way or the other way. You are going to create a bias in the decision-making of a judge. When judge looks at an issue of law, is this law constitutional or unconstitutional? It's either one or the other. We cannot create a situation that if it is unconstitutional, then a certain number of people need to agree, and if it is not, it's absurd. Well, listen, you know, I can only apply my own mind. The Germans have done their own. But if you look at the point of view of some somebody who is applying his mind to an issue, it's one way or the other. And in any collegial body, including this committee, the issue is decided by majority. And it is always one person who keeps the balance. And creating a bias in favor of the constitutionality of a law may undoubtedly serve the agenda of the ruling party of the day. Today the ANC, tomorrow the DA, the day after the ISP. So I'm not making this a personal comment. But it does not make for this judgment to be a better judgment, because there is no logical reason why that should be the case.
Look at, I mean, unfortunately, we weren't blessed with his presence on the German trip, but I would suggest you look at.
No. You know full well that when it comes to overseas trips, there are processes, and these are determined by the proportions each party has in this national assembly, and also by a roster system whereby the person who went on the previous trip falls out the next trip. So please don't say we arranged for you not to go. That's not fair. All right. Honourable members, can we move on? I'm not saying we're done with this.
That's it. Then on the next page, it's quite an important change there to B. We've changed de novo to afresh.
You may certainly do.
Okay, and then in 13, in fact, in 2 instances we've changed de novo to afresh.
Mm-hmm.
And in 4 I've omitted informa pauperis and substituted as a poor person in chambers. Of course you will have a little bit of a clash with the rules, informa rules of course, but I'm sure that the judiciary is probably intelligent enough to know what the intention
is. Chairman, we all in this committee we all know what informa pauperis means. In 20 years, people sitting in this committee will not know it any longer.
How long ago did Latin die out as a spoken language?
On page 12, clause 14. Again, there are 2 instances where I've replaced the novo with a fresh. Just to get back to the informa pauperis, interestingly enough, while trying to find the appropriate wording, I think one should just, I needn't even mention to this committee, but one of the benefits of an expression like this is in legal systems world over, this expression appears. Whether they're even English-speaking or not, you will find it there. So there is some kind of attraction to the fact that it's a universally recognized concept. But be it as it may, I don't think...
May I ask a question? Will you also outlaw words like et cetera, vice versa, volta facie? I mean, how far do we take it? That constitution killed the word shell. Yes, which we all understood and our children will not understand.
I was born speaking Zulu as my mother tongue. Later on, English became my mother tongue. The closest I came to Latin was in Catholic Church Mass, and then it was by rote. There's very little we understood of what we were praying and singing in Latin, so I don't know what impendite sounds like, something about a bandit. No pandit. Yeah, bro.
Chairman, is the Honorable Jeffrey also going to outlaw lip tendons? Because it's the same expression. Local standard.
All right, Mr.
DeLanger. Thanks, Chair. I think it's going to be an ongoing process, and progress will be made.
Painful for some.
Yes, then I think Mr. Jeffrey just referred to on page 14. There's a sub 3 there.
That one is really
by one starts against the other for maintenance pendente litae. That was one of the areas where I did not have the courage to try and find something there, although it seemed not that complicated. It's probably just another way of saying Nemo plus Juris et Aliam transferre hotel from which to abide. Maintenance pending the outcome or finalization of the proceedings, possibly chair. If with your leave, I will see. Maybe we can in fact come and then something last day. The major changes, or next relatively major changes, clause 17, the issue of leave to appeal. In 2D, there's quite a bit of changes I made there, and that was under instruction of the committee. The judges considering an application referred to in paragraph A may dispose of the application without the hearing of oral argument, but may, if they are of opinion that the circumstances so require, order that it be argued according to time and place, etc. Then I added a new E. Actually not added, I changed to E, where an application has been referred to the court in terms of paragraph D. The court may thereupon grant or refuse it, and F, the decision of the majority of the judges considering an application referred to in paragraph B, and the rest of it. It's mainly grammatical, but I think it was preference of the committee at the time. Next page in sub 7, subsection 2, that is just consequential to what was done earlier. Then, in clause 18, members will notice that I've inserted a footnote 17 there. And my footnote reads, evaluation of Robin Nathan case pendency comment of the LHSA raises clause. Members may recall that the Legal Society of South Africa, they made an argument and a request. They asked that an amendment be inserted in the bill to bring the provisions of the bill in line with Section 36, I think, of the Magistrates Courts Act, in terms of which a debtor can apply to a court for a rescission of the judgment. Typically, apparently, to my understanding, it would happen in cases where judgment has been given against the debtor, it's been settled, now the debtor wants to clear his or her name, and they, with the leave of the creditor, of the judgment creditor, apply to the court to just for rescission of the judgment, meaning that it's deemed that it's never taken place. Now, I've also learned that, well, it's not clear also from the LHSA representation, the Magistrates Court Act was specifically amended in 2002 to enable the rules of the Magistrates Court Act to allow this provision to be followed in the Magistrates Courts. But there's not a similar situation currently in the Supreme Court of South Africa or in the Supreme Courts. And their representation boils down to the fact that they want a provision in the bill similar to that in the Magistrates Court Act. But then they also drew our attention to this bill, the Nathan case. It's a case that I think was delivered in 2010, where the judge was very critical of that provision in the Magistrates Court Act. The judge held views that the law must be final, you cannot deal with fictions, that some things never occurred, what about restitution, integrum, etc. So I'm in a bit, I won't say an argument, but I am in a bit of an exchange with the rules board specifically, because they also are supporting this amendment, and it is pending at the moment. It will probably be in the course of this week. We'll come to. I don't want to confuse the committee and jump into things which I think may probably even require a little bit of feedback from the judiciary themselves as well. So I just want to register that this is one of the flag issues, and unfortunately it must still be flagged. Then the next change here is in clause 21, simply magistrates' courts being inserted as opposed to lower courts. Then 26, 21, 3. Members will see that or note that I am proposing that we omit that paragraph B of sub 3. In other words, there will just be a sub 3 and there will not be any B. Sub clause 4 there that's being omitted, that was on the instruction of the committee. Members might recall that. But just to return to that sub B, this emanates from a remark by the comment by the Constitutional Court judges in their document paragraph 18. They said they pointed out that there is this contradiction between 21.3b, which says that if not removed, it would mean that a division may, where a plaintiff is resident or domiciled within the area jurisdiction, but the cause of action arose outside the area of jurisdiction, issue an order for the attachment of property to found jurisdiction, regardless of where in the Republic the property or person is situated. And if members then skip to clause 28, you'll see that it says no attachment of property to found jurisdiction shall be ordered by a division against a person who is resident in the Republic. Now clearly there is some contradiction here, or in any event, the Constitutional Court pointed that out. What I've done here is, as I've mentioned earlier, Chair, I think the committee indicated is working towards submitting a bill for further input by the judiciary or just remarks from the judiciary. I thought it makes sense on the face of it to follow this route, in other words, that there's merit in what the Constitutional Court has pointed out, to omit it, but I would really like to have some input on whether there's any unintended consequences if one should go this route. I had a fairly discussion on this issue with your esteemed researcher, Ms. Silkstone. I found it very difficult to follow her arguments because she used terms like peregrini and incoli, etc., much above me, but she might wish to add something to this, Chair, a bit about the history of this provision.
I actually look at clause 28, and the history of clause 28 is predates even the union, where jurisdiction did not run from one area to one court to the next. The jurisdiction of superior courts didn't run across the whole country. So you would need to attach property if you were resident in the country in another court's jurisdiction, so you would be in peregrinus in another court's jurisdiction. So it was a historical thing. I haven't finally decided on the connection between what 21 and 28. I think that needs to go to the Constitution.
Chair, just to discuss Ms. Smith, just think whether she found, in fact, what I was referring to. It's a short three-page submission. On paragraph 18, page 3. Paragraph 18, page 3. Yes. Then 22, just a change from lower courts to magistrates' courts. 23 deals with default judgment, Chair. This was discussed at some length. There were proposals by the committee that one should add specifically that you cannot give the judgment by the court, then it might result in the eviction of a person from property. The comments, the Constitutional Court judges also commented in this regard. I did not do anything at this stage. I put in the two footnotes. The one is just the note 19. What it was, I don't think the problem lies with the Act. It lies with the rules. The Constitutional Court said in that case that you cannot, the rules cannot allow for, you cannot in terms of the rules give a judgment by default. That would result in somebody being evicted. If you look at the Gondwana case, that was what they referred to. I've got the order from the Gondwana case there. But the rules cannot trump any other law or jurisprudence of the courts, especially the Constitutional Court. Now, there would not be a problem to add a qualification here to say that you can grant access by, or you can give judgment by default in the manner and circumstances prescribed in the rules, and then add to it, but you can never do it in terms of, or whenever it might result in the eviction of a person. My problem with doing that, and it's maybe not a big problem, is, as I said, the problem would lie with the rules. The rules would be, it would be unconstitutional in this instance for the rules to even attempt to allow something like that. But it is very likely that there might be other problems relating to rules, and I don't think it is necessarily wise every time that there's a problem with your secondary legislation to come and bring across references in your principal legislation to those. I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear, Chair. So I think the bottom line is you can put it in here. I don't think it's necessary. And if you do it, it might be creating a precedent to follow in that same course in future cases.
I have a substantive input on 23. May I give it to you now, Mr. Chairman? This is something I flagged as an area of concern, because I feel actually the opposite than Advocate Elanga states. I think we need to flesh out more. 23 doesn't do anything. It purports to give a constitutional backing to the rules deciding where and when a default judgment may be entered in. Now, there are certain rules that we all agree with, that nobody would consider not being in place. The fact that you cannot have a default judgment unless and until the parties have been served. That they could not be left in the rules. Unless it's not sure whether it's set out somewhere else. But it should be in the legislation, because it's a basic constitutional protection that you cannot enter into a default judgment unless the party has been served. Now, served how? Again, it's in the rules. Personal service, we will all agree that personal service is sufficient to have a default judgment. But what about service by, which is not personal service? What about service by a return received later, which may have been or may not have been received? I feel very uncomfortable in leaving matters which involve these basic constitutional rights and protections in rules which are beyond what this parliament writes. And I appreciate that there is a provision further down that says we are going to get a chance to look at the rules and they need to be approved by. But that's, I think it's in 29. If that is a concern, I think I would like to see at least some criteria for the discretion, where the rules which provide the adequate services factually and actually received by the person, and opportunities being given to the person to appear in court if he had an opportunity, if you were willing to do so.
What happens unconstitutional for a registrar of a high court to declare movable property, especially if it's registrable when ordering default judgment under Rule 15.15, to the extent that it permits the sale of execution of the home of a person. So presumably there was an application for eviction well, it's the home that presumably those are which those exist. And in order to recover the debt, the home was to be sold. What happens if the person, the defendant, never comes to court? So you serve and everything on them. And they know that, look, you'll never be able to sell my house if I just avoid the court. I mean, what is the process then? On the reading of Iwana. I mean, I can see on the one hand it's to prevent, I mean, it's your home, and you do have, I mean, the reason this provision for rescission of judgment, and it's quite often used, is you do have people who get served, who don't know what to do, who may be panicked and hope it will go away, and then the next time they look, their house is sold in sale of execution. So it's for that, but then how, on the other extreme, do you prevent somebody from, who knows the law, from defeating the recovery of a debt by just simply never going to court?
Yes. Now, speaking under correction, I seem to recall that there's also a rule that may provision that in such case you can publish in a newspaper if the debtor is availing service. But I'll have to get back to you. This is just what I seem to recall. I think it, I don't think there is a cap there. They do take the point.
I think it's an issue of what's been wrong with the section. I think we can't spell out in the bill when you can't give people justice, because it seems to be otherwise qualified. So even a requirement, there does seem to then be an exception that even if you your home is to be sold, you can't use the provision to escape. That there is a way out of that. So, you know, basically what I'm saying, I'm not sure then what Mr. Langer wants us to do, but I would see that the current wording of 23 is fine.
Yes, that's my point is just, I don't think the problem lies with the wording. I think it is fine. I don't think it's... You can add further qualifications if you'd like to, but I don't think it's strictly speaking necessary.
You add qualifications specifically referring to sale of execution of a home, then you're going to have to add the qualifier.
It becomes complicated. for example, by creating an option that you may have a quite a comprehensive set of rules in front of you, and you're not in a position to deal with it within 60 or 90 days, and you don't want this deeming provision to kick in, but, and I thought maybe Parliament should just pass a motion that this time period can be extended until they've dealt with it. I think the reason why you need this is to avoid situations where Parliament may be in recess or things do take a very long time, but I'll leave it obviously for the members to discuss this a little bit here. Then in 30, the rules of the SCA and High Court, Magistrates Courts, and then 2, I've just changed to bring it into line with what is stated in 29, the provisions of 29, 2 and 3 also apply to rules referred to in subsection 1. And then there's a proposed amendment to the Rules Board, in my footnote 21. Maybe it is appropriate just to go directly to that, Chair. That is in Schedule 2, first item in Schedule 2. It's on page 31 of the board. I think, again, the committee expressed the view that it might be appropriate for the Chief Justice to be ex officio the chairperson of the Rules Board or Courts of Law. And that first amendment there is just to indicate to the MIT committee what the exact amendment would be if that route is chosen. It would mean that the Chief Justice is always the chairperson. At the moment, as members can see, it can either be a Constitutional Court judge, an ACA judge, or a High Court judge, and the minister designates one of those as the chairperson of the Rules Board. Obviously, that is something that the committee would want to bounce off the judges as well. Yes, if the committee decides to go that route, finally, Chair, I may need, not necessarily, you don't want to overcomplicate things, but you may need a transitional provision because at the moment there would be a chairperson who would not be chairperson any longer. But because this is such an isolated incident, it's probably not even necessary to he or she can just say, okay, you take over now. Take it off as an enemy. Mr. Jeffrey has pointed out that provision. I do think 41, the director of the general of the department should probably be secretary general. Which is 41, sub 1, sorry, it was right at the bottom of page 23. It is transmitted to the register of the division by the director general of the department. It should probably be by the secretary general. Well, it's defined, so it's not necessary to define it even, to go beyond that. It's just a thought, so we'll just play around with that a bit further. Yes. In this instance, let me just make sure about this, because it will be coming from the Department of Foreign Affairs, probably, Security Justice. So it may even be required appropriate to keep our or the DP judges. Well, Chair, I'm sorry for that confusion. 41, I've just removed the words in 41. One at the bottom, C, the rising of the court. I think Mr. Jeffrey didn't quite understand what it means, so I thought, let's say, until the court adjusts. Now, in my discussion with Ms. Falkstein, she doesn't really understand what it means, but I said, look, the more people understand what it means when the court adjusts than when the court rises.
It's a French word. Adjourn. Yes. It's French, yes.
Okay, can I proceed? Part 3, the process, just the lower court in clause 42 there, just changed lower to magistrate's courts. Nothing in 43, nothing in 44, nothing in 45. Yes, the words wearing apparel being substituted by clothes. The 44 is the property not liable to be seized in execution, and 45 rather. And then at the committee thought that maybe it's out of date, all the implements of trade, etc. So I proposed a provisional alternative that might be considered to simply say that the sheriff or deputy sheriff may not seize an execution in case of such belongings of the debtor as prescribed, which would mean it would, through the regulations, then come to Parliament. But the court concerned may, in exceptional circumstances and on such conditions as it may determine, in its discretion allow a specific deviation from the prescribed provisions. And in this regard, this proviso, I just want to refer to the proviso there in the original provision. It says, provided that the court concerned may, in exceptional circumstances and on such conditions as it may determine in its discretion, increase the amount specified in these paragraphs B, C, E, or F. Now, those are amounts that the minister can currently prescribe. For example, if the debtor is a fitter and turner and he's got all this equipment, then the minister will say, look, he must leave at least 100,000 rands worth of equipment for this guy so he can continue to earn a living. And then the court's got a discretion to up that amount. So I thought maybe if one goes for a general option in 45, it would be a good idea to retain the court's discretion, but play it both ways. You can up or down, since you're in any end giving the court a discretion, which would leave very little room for abuse, Chair.
Is that it's very archaic in terms of farmers and things like that. That would be the issue. I prefer the alternative, which is broader, because why do farmers get specifically mentioned? I mean, you do have tools of an instrument of trade. If we get to 46, I mean, one thing that Mr. Lange missed, is I see he's coming down in the amendment, and there's no amendment 46, but one I just noticed seems to need to be changed. Offences relating to execution. Any person who be being aware that goods are under arrest. Now, my refrigerator is under arrest. when, how 50 years ago good, they arrested goods?
Chairperson, but there are several ships here in Captain Harbour that are under arrest. Yeah, but it's unfortunately one of those funny cases. I'm sure you came on the same basis that you arrested the ship, yes. Then you must explain the rights.
It does. I mean, I can see that I mean, it's. I can see that it does have meaning, but to the average reader, it's bizarre. And it might be cross-referencing it with other legislation, other that legislation has been changed. Not cross-referencing it to the sections, but has this been updated as far as legislation relating to carriers and things like that?
Thank you, Chief. We will follow up on that. In 47, no changes there, Chief. As I remarked to Ms. Silkstone, I'm actually a bit surprised that this one has not elicited any substantive comment, but believe that it would make. 48, nothing. 49, nothing. It might be appropriate. I've not done it. But if the committee prefers the route in 45, then it might be appropriate to put a specific reference in here to say that the minister makes regulations regarding the goods that might not be seized by the sheriff. I'm Chair. Mr. Olamisa, I think, specifically raised this issue. There are some changes in 51, sub 1 of clause 50. Members will see that I've added, for example, in 51B, Eastern Cape High Court Grahamstown becomes the main seat of that, instead of just the Eastern Cape High Court Division. I've done the same in E, G, I, J and K. K, of course, again, the issue of my king, and then the Western Cape High Court F. The last subsection there is 5. We've added the President may with a view to facilitating promoting effective of the consultation with the Chief Justice and the Minister and with the consent of the judge concerned, transfer any judge of a division to the Limpopo, Mpumalanga or Northwest Division. Yes.
Then we do now have a section on transitional provisions. Should 2, 3, 4, and 5 not go under transitional provisions?
Already, Chair, this is transitional provisions we're dealing with.
Oh, okay, it's existing High Court transitional provisions. Sorry, I didn't see that overall heading of the chart.
51, nothing there. 52, nothing there. 53, nothing there. And then this issue of financial accountability, that would be new. I very cleverly slotted that in as 54, Chair, so as to avoid the need to have cross references going cockeyed all over the book. There's only two clauses after that. It is basically a repeat of what we present, what we had in the original 10, 2 and 3. 1 is exactly the same, and 2 is also the same, apart from the fact that Director General has been substituted for Secretary General. Okay, with your leave, if I can move on to nothing in 55 or 56, then the first schedule. Members raised the issue when we looked at the schedule the previous time about these, all these so-called TBCC constitutions that are only selectively being repealed selectively at this stage. It's items 4, 5, 6, my attention that there is actually a Judicial Matters Fourth Amendment Bill in the pipeline that is appealing those constitutions in total, the whole of those constitutions. And I've now raised, I'm in total, I've engaged I must look clever even if I am not, and I'm trying to sound clever. Maybe some people will be fooled some of the time. I've engaged Mr. Bassett on this issue. They've assured me that there's nothing in those constitutions of any consequence. Because I raised and I asked him, look, shouldn't we then just repeal it in this bill? We don't want to do it lightly because it's quite a significant to do if there's any consequences. Apparently at this stage there are no consequences, but I'm not yet personally satisfied. I will satisfy myself in 3 days or so. And then the committee, it might be up to the committee to decide to just repeal. My information is that these things that we're repealing now are really the only living parts. It's been kept alive by the interim provisions in the Constitution itself. And some even held the view that these constitutions could have been repealed already, and I said no. That's why I'm a bit worried to say it must just go ahead, because they then forgot that the courts there at the moment, this is how they function. So you can't simply repeal it. You can only repeal it once this bill becomes law. Then we can cover the gap that will be allowed. But other than that, I will get back to the committee too. And then, of course, it's for you to decide. I mean, it's not necessary to do it, but if you feel that it's appropriate, you can just go ahead. Schedule 2, we've already covered that. That's the issue of the new rules board. Members might notice that there are a few instances there. Thank you.
Schedule 1. Thank you. The Constitutional Court Complementary Act. I don't have it with me. I was sure that there is nothing that needs to be kept. I mean, the Honorable Jeffrey was relying on it in respect of the just an hour ago on the in respect of the provisions which would enable the Chief Justice to and the Justice to choose their own people. So how does that work? Yeah, but he was reading and said, don't worry, Mario, this is going to be taken care of by this act this year. Let's leave it the way it is. But here we are repealing it in the whole.
Referring to the fact that the wording in the Constitutional Court Complementary Act and the wording in the bill relating to the appointment of the staff is the same.
I don't want to reopen. I know that I'm the only person sent between you and lunch, but the provision that the Honorable Jeffrey was quoting was giving a power to the court, while our bill gives it to the minister. I just want to make
Dr. Ambrosini's benefit. The minister shall, subject to the laws governing the public service, on the request of and in consultation with the president of the court, appoint for the court a registrar, assistant registrars, and other officers and staff members when they may be required. Blah blah. Who was trying to say, if you've forgotten, Dr. Ambrosini, that that the Constitutional Court didn't appoint according to the laws governing the public service, and I pointed out with the Complementary Act that it does specifically. That was the sole purpose. But here's, well, we were all given a copy of this. I would suggest Dr. Ambrosini's concern is valid. Maybe Mr. Lange can assure us now, or else he can check on it and come back to us.
But I can also assure you now that we've used two pieces of legislation when we draft the Supreme Court bill. Everything applicable from the Supreme Court Act, but lots of amendments there, because that's very old. And then everything that is applicable in this Complementary Act. So most of the things, in fact, all of the things in the Complementary Act has been taken over into this bill too. We've actually dealt with it. The only reason I've highlighted the lower courts there is just to register the expression that's being used there, but it's in the Rules Board of the Courts of Law Act. So we don't need to, if it's got a specific meaning there, we don't need to concern ourselves with it. Yeah, and then we've run through the whole thing, Jeff.
What's the opposite of in linea? At the end, the point. Post at the end. Out of the window. Sorry. Now, there was a last point on this bill, Mr. Chairman, which I've noted. You will remember that I don't know whether I've missed receiving the document, but I thought we'd agreed, and surely I requested a legal opinion on whether or not this needs to go to the House of Traditional Leaders before we approve it, in consideration of referring to all courts, and especially in consideration of repealing the constitution to the TPDC state under which many of the traditional courts are currently operating, and also in consideration of the fact that the President has recently sent back to Parliament the Intellectual Property Law Amendment Bill, exactly on the ground of the House of Traditional Leaders not being consulted in what appears to be a piece of legislation with a much lesser impact on traditional matters than the one before us. I haven't received a legal opinion as it's been distributed, and I've missed on something.
Well, with Dr. Ambassini raising this before, and it being pointed out to him that traditional courts are not the courts referred to in this bill. In no way does it relate to traditional courts. Also, for Dr. Ambassini's benefit, the provisions relating to traditional courts are not in the Constitution of the Republic of Transvaal Constitution Act, the Republic of Botswana Constitution Act, the Republic of Bender Constitution Act, or the Republic of Biscay Constitution Decree. They are in the Black Administration Act, sections 12 and 20, and the third schedule of the Black Administration Act. And that is the bill that we are needing, those are the sections that we need to keep alive. And the House later this afternoon will be hopefully granting the committee permission to proceed with a bill to keep those sections alive. So those sections are not, the issues relating to the traditional courts are not in the those constitutions of the former Bantustans. They are in the Black Administration Act.
Chairman, I'll be very quick. That's why I would like to have a reader opinion, because we are proceeding on the basis of Honourable Jeffrey saying so. And it may be right, it may be wrong. I understand the Black Administration Act only applying to the self-governing territories and not to the TPDC states. I may be wrong. But being as it may, it seems a point which is quite important. We need to apply our mind. We can have our advisor applying our mind. I don't see why, if Mr. Jeffrey is in fact correct, what he says or what other people and staff could not be put down on a written opinion.
Look at the bill. The bill is quite clearly superior court, and then it goes through definitions. All right, and it is high court. It is magistrates court. Okay, there's no reference. Traditional courts are not included.
The bill says in many aspects all courts, and I do not know whether a traditional court is a court. And when the bill says all courts, which says in many of
the... Where does it say all courts?
I promise you, it does refer to all courts. In several...
The bill quite clearly, and that's why it's in the definitions, is not all courts. It is high court and magistrates court. Superior court is the constitution. So when they talk about all courts, they mean all courts defined in this bill.
Okay.
Where Dr. Ambrosini may have a point is that he may want to go and check the sections, and I suggest he may be thinking he's so concerned the sections are listed in the schedule of these Bantustan constitutions to see if they do relate to traditional courts in those territories. And if they do, then I think that they, I would agree that they should not be, those sections should come out.
Okay. So if this, Mr. Chairman, this is what we want, we can double check where it says of course, and it says it on a few occasions, huh? And then we can have a provision that defines courts to the exclusion of traditional courts. Then we are all on safe grounds and all in agreement.
Gracias.